Welcome to Simple Life Radio, stories for the adventurous at heart. I'm your host today, Cynthia Fernandez, and for this next hour, we're going to focus on the real life experiences and perspectives from the folks on the coast of Central California. And normally, this show is dedicated to local voices, but our guest today on Simple Life Radio, author Greg Orfila, is representing, in a way, a well-known local, someone who had his birthday celebrated throughout the state of California. On November 24th, 2013, he turned 300 years old. Just released this month, Journey to the Sun, Junipero Serra's Dream, and the Founding of California is Greg's ninth book, and it's been described as a combination of biography, anthropology, religion, and geography. Welcome, Greg.
Good to be here, Cynthia.
Well, it's really nice to have you in the studio with me. Now, I just want to get started. This is the Junipero Serra that was born 1713, lived 70 years until 1784. He left Spain for the New World in 1749. The priest eventually founded 9 missions, baptized some 6,000 Native Americans, and left an indelible mark on the American West. Originally born in Majorca, Spain, he became a friar and was a scholar of theology, then spent years in Mexico founding missions in Baja California. And in 1769, when he was in his mid-50s, journeyed north to San Diego, where he founded the religion's first missions and died at the age of 70. So, Greg, my question for you is, what drew you to take this particular project on to begin with?
Well, Father Serra, to me, Cynthia, has, you know, in my own life, I identify discovering him with my first conscious memory.
Really?
Yeah, I was 2.5, and I only know that because it's marked on the back of a photograph that was taken of me when I was 2.5 at Mission San Juan Capistrano.
Oh, really?
And at the in this photograph that also recalls this early memory for me, I was feeding birdseed to a bird who was kind of climbing down my arm, my upraised palm, and he was pecking away at my wrist. And I can even to this day remember how weird that felt, getting at my tendons and all. I was just, like I say, a little boy, sort of scary. My uncle was pouring the seed into my palm. And years later, you know, in my recollection of it, without seeing the photo, I thought, oh, it must have been a swallow, because the swallows come back to Capistrano.
That's right.
And then I discovered the picture. My mother says, take a look at that picture, you know, in my 40s. And sure enough, it was a pigeon. So I came close to the myth, but not quite.
Oh, wow.
So it's a very early memory to me.
And you spent an incredible amount of time putting this book together. There was, 12 years?
Yeah, I wrote the first outline in 2001. And for many years did a lot of reading in, as you mentioned, history, anthropology, geography, the environment, Christian theology, philosophy, psychology, too, for that matter. And read up and traveled, went to as many of the missions as I could with my children too, as it turned out, my 3 boys.
Right.
And little by little, I began to formulate the idea of the book.
That's amazing. Now, for our listeners, you should know that Greg Orfila is the director for the Center of. Not now.
You saying
a
Claremont?
Retired, yes.
Yeah, I was teaching for 3 years at the Claremont Colleges, but
Today
I've been teaching writing at Westmont College in Santa Barbara.
Oh, nice. Thank you for that update. So here's a quote that I took from your book. Priests took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, but they never took one against power. And Greg, I was really struck by the pairing of power between the church and the military.
Yeah.
Were you?
Oh, yeah. It's a theme that runs through Serra's whole life, particularly in California. He was constantly at loggerheads with the military over the treatment of the Indians. No matter what criticisms people have of Serra, and of course there are some valid ones, I think without a question. He was extremely he defended the Indians with extreme ardor. I mean, he really castigated the Spanish comandantes for allowing soldiers to molest the Indian women, for allowing them all kinds of liberties, or not punishing them for their actions.
Right, not holding them accountable.
Exactly, and Sarah did. Sarah went all the way back to Mexico City to get one of the comandantes, Rivera, cashiered because he was not disciplining the soldiers.
Oh, wow.
So he put his reputation, his life on the line, speaking to the viceroy, and the viceroy backed
right.
him up.
Right. So at age 31, I guess Father Sarah has been a philosophy professor, and there was an epidemic taking 10,000 people very quickly.
Yeah.
Your book describes that the circumstances, the symptoms actually presented fatal in 5 days.
Yeah, this is in Mallorca now. You're talking about
in Mallorca, Spain,
where he was born.
Yeah, before he left for the New World.
Right.
And at that point, it was a really turning point for him, where he began a 5-year role for the Lillian University.
Lillian University, right.
Yeah. What would you guess his mindset to be at that point? I mean, here are all these deaths going on around, an epidemic in the land, a very poor time and place.
Yeah.
And then he's in this university setting.
Clash.
And, yeah.
Total clash of mentality, of disposition. Here he is with these fine robes, these velvet gold and red robes at important events, at funerals, at graduation, and people are dying, you know, in droves and by the thousands.
That's, yeah.
Even starving to death because there was such a bad famine. I think that it had something to do with thrusting him out of the old world. Everything was dying around him. In fact, if you remember in the book, Cynthia, there's several of his former teachers, colleagues that die, up and die around him in the late 1740s before he finally makes the decision to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think in a sense his world was dying around him.
Yeah, it really seemed that way to me when I was reading through your book. So then just a little bit later, there's a point where Father Sarah and a colleague make their way to the Cadiz to take voyage to the New World.
Right.
And you write, suspiciously, they didn't have papers authorizing their travel, saying that they were lost. So it also said that no one would claim a priest to be a liar because they were afraid they'd be excommunicated. And I'm just wondering, do you think that they were so determined to go to the New World that even though they had been refused authorization numerous times by the government, that they just sort of made it happen?
Yeah, do you think they forged the papers? Is that what you're
saying?
Well,
there were no papers. There were no papers. They said they were lost.
No, they did finally arrive
later. Okay.
It was sent twice.
Oh.
The first time, somebody probably purloined them, took them, who didn't like them, didn't want them to get their dream to go to the New World. There's a sense of that in the book. But then Madrid, the officials in Madrid, realizing that they hadn't heard anything back from these priests that were asking to go to the New World, they hadn't gotten any papers signed or anything the official documents returned to them, they sent them a second time, and they sent them by special courier.
That was diligent.
Yeah, that was. So even the bureaucracy in the 18th century sort of corrected itself, and they finally got the go-ahead.
Awesome. You know, the other part of your book, Greg, we're speaking with Greg Orfila, the author of Journey to the Sun, Junipero Serra's Dream, and the Founding of California. Right. The other part in your book that I thought was significant was when Father Sarah decided to drop the, as he put it, the pomp of titles, and instead to use his first name and his colleague as well.
Right.
And I also, I loved the fact that in his addressing his priesthood stage of life, choosing a name, you know, someone that he looked up to and perhaps wanted to emulate,
right.
He chose Junipero, which means clown of God.
Yeah, Junipero Serra. His name was Miguel originally,
yes.
Or Mikel, as it is in Mallorquin. And he chose, and he was, you know, Sarah was a fairly serious-minded person, even as a young man. He was not one with an extraordinary burlesque sense of humor. He had a kind of academician's, you know, stinging irony sense of humor. And well, who does he pick? Like you say, Blessed Junipero, who was Francis of Assisi's best friend.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's where Blessed Junipero, or Brother Juniper, as he's sometimes called in English, was this jongleur de Dieu, clown of God. And he did all these funny things like did you see the big pot of stew that he puts together, throwing whole chickens in without plucking their feathers and eggs without taking off the shells?
Uh-oh.
And all the brothers said, "What are you doing wasting food?" And he says, "Oh, I thought I would save time." So this wild man of God, you know, that caused all the early Franciscans to tear their hair out, that Francis loved.
Yeah.
Sarah picks Junipero. I think he was looking for a lighter spirit that he did not have.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that crossed my mind was that perhaps he chose the name to take a different tact in the world, maybe one that was less traditional or one that was less confrontational.
Yeah. Obviously, Junipero, the original brother Junipero, had something that he wanted and also valued.
Mm.
And I think he did value that blithe spirit, the humbleness, the ability to see joy in simple things. He certainly found a lot of joy in the beauty of California.
Yes, many times it was mentioned that he just felt so blessed to be among such natural beauty.
Yeah. I imagined, I don't know, I took a bit of a risk. One of his theological forerunners or models was St. Bonaventure. And Bonaventure taught that, you know, Christ's crucifixion, which is a terrible suffering, was a ladder. He describes it in almost mystical terms, that it was a ladder from earth to heaven, to God, that suffering. And there are times, if you remember in the book, where I see this ladder of light that goes across the Santa Barbara Channel to Santa Cruz Island. And it seemed to me, and I retraced Sarah's steps many times. One day I was just driving the Cuesta Grade out of San Luis Obispo in the early morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, you know, the sun just slowly pulling the shadow up the Santa Lucia Mountains. And I stopped off the road for a couple hours and just took notes on how that happened.
Wow.
Same thing with the ladder of light across the San Barbara Channel. So I thought, I want to see California
the way he did.
Exactly. And in a way, the way the Indians did too. For the first time a European really spends time seeing it, the way an Indian would see it without all the clutter of our day and the craziness of the freeways, to slow down.
Yeah, good for you. You know, I really applaud your in-depth research on this particular project. We're in studio today. Our guest is Greg Orfila, author of Journey to the Sun, a biography of Junipero Serra's life. And it's just been released today, actually, for sale at Pilgrim's Way Community Bookstore in Secret Garden in downtown Carmel. There are signed copies in the front of the store if you weren't able to come in before now. And when we come back, we're going to learn about Father Serra's 20-year affliction and much more. Stay tuned to Radio Monterey. I'm your host, Cynthia Fernandez, and this is Simple Life. Stay with us. Back. This is Simple Life Radio. I'm your host, Cynthia Fernandez. Our guest today, Greg Orfila, is the author of the book Journey to the Sun, Junipero Serra's Dream, and the Founding of California. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this show, Father Sarah is the actual local, and Greg is representing him as he just celebrated his 300th birthday last year. That would be Father Sarah, not Greg.
Yeah, let's hope.
So, Greg, you know, going into the break, I let people know we want to find out about this 20-year affliction that Father Sarah had. And from reading through your book, I was really captured by this, because there are so many references to his having pain in his leg. And
yeah.
He loved the Pacific Ocean because he would go out and the cold water would sort of numb and soothe that that terrible affliction. And I thought that I read somewhere that it was actually a spider bite from when he came over to the New World.
Yeah, it's. I tried to correct what I think is an assumption of the erroneous assumption to date. You know, Father Maynard Geiger wrote the wonderful predecessor to my own work, a 2-volume biography of Sarah, 900 pages, in 1959, called The Life and Times in Upper Sarah. And unfortunately, it was, you know, published on a smaller press, a Franciscan press, and it was very expensive and is long out of print. So in a way, A Journey to the Sun is, you know, sort of an update 50 years later. One of the things Father Geiger claims, and it comes really out of the first biography, Francisco Palou's biography in 1787, Sarah's best friend, or one of his two best friends, who says he was bitten by a mosquito, a zancudo. Well, I talked to doctors, and, you know, all through his story, through Palou's renditions, even through Sarah's own diary and letters, he talks about this terrible pain in one of his legs.
His left leg?
Left leg, lower calf, and ankle and foot.
Did it progress from the ankle up, or do you know?
I don't know exactly where the bite or the sting occurred, but I talked to one very renowned doctor in Washington, D.C., who teaches medicine at Georgetown University Hospital and Med School. So he's an authority, and he says there is no way that a mosquito bite would necrotize for 20 years or ulcerate and become infected to such an extent that it would pain him for 20 years. He says it was either a spider or a scorpion. Now, I think if it were a scorpion, Sarah would have known that. That's a pretty big little
item. Yeah. Well, it certainly looks different. It looks pretty grimacing. And he did start out, when he came to the New World, he started out in Baja, California, or Mexico.
Yeah, he started in Mexico and then went to Baja, which was part of Mexico, of course.
Right.
Yeah. And the bite occurred just after he landed in Veracruz in 1749. He was a young priest, 36, first footprints in the New World in that pestilential port of Veracruz. It was very low and boggy. There were a lot of mosquitoes, but there were also a lot of spiders.
Sure.
And I think because he walked from Veracruz 150 to 200 miles to Mexico City.
Without hiking boots,
with sandals.
Yeah.
And he slept out in the open. It's very likely a sand spider bit him. That's almost certain. So it wasn't a zancudo. It was a spider.
And then he wouldn't take any medicine, I read. Yeah. He only one time used mule salve.
Right. That's right. Good for you. You picked that up. Well, you know, Sarah believed, and this is one of my favorite quotes in the book, in a wealth of sufferings. He spoke to those Claritian nuns in Mallorca before he left and said, start congratulating yourselves. And all the nuns sort of tittered and thought, what is coming now? You're going to be given a wealth of sufferings. You know, and I could just imagine the women, the nuns thinking, oh, here's another man telling me to suffer
really.
And be quiet. But what he was really saying was that the way to understand Christ's life and its sacrifice for us on the cross is to realize that suffering can ennoble. You know, it can make us come to a higher level if we transmute it to that higher level. It doesn't have to sink us. It can actually make us better.
Well, I know from what little bit of suffering I've had in my own personal life that it's a great facilitator of humility.
Yes.
And depending on how you respond to discomfort, embarrassment, whatever your version of suffering is, it could be physical pain or mental, emotional pain. However you respond to it, I think, determines whether it goes to humility or maybe rage or, you know, blaming.
Or self-pity. Or
self-pity is just a pit.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they call it pity, right?
Never thought of that. I'll try and remember that.
And it seems as though, you know, the criticisms that I collected about Father Sarah had to do with the fact that, yes, even though he was an advocate, let's say, for the Native people in many, many ways, he was also very well known for being someone who would not hold a lash back. He very evenly distributed punishments. And I wonder if it's related to this healthy respect or maybe even adoration
for suffering.
Of suffering.
That's a very, very insightful question and not an easy one to answer, because your question presumes almost a sort of, you know, spiritual psychology. Did he, you know, psychologists talk about transference. Did he transfer, in a way, his own feeling about the necessity to suffer, the necessity to suffer joyfully or honorably to the Indians who, you know, certainly had no notion of the flog, although they did. There was a version of, not flogging, but Indians, some Indian tribes in California would send prisoners of war down a gauntlet, and they'd hit them maybe with sticks. So it wasn't totally out of the realm of the possible for them in that sense, but it was different, and they hated it, and understandably so.
Understandably so.
So I don't know how to answer that except to say that to him, the floggings were for penance and for discipline. You know, the Indians were part of a community.
And he felt in good conscience about that.
He was trying to save their souls. If they had adulterous relationships with women outside their marriage, if they stole, if they beat someone up, or even left the mission without permission, which, of course, is a little more questionable from our perspectives, he was in danger of them losing their souls if he didn't discipline them.
Right, right. Yeah. So, you know, you inferred that Father Sarah was greatly influenced by the Native Americans when recounting their perspective, and I'm just going to quote here. The sea, the rock, the sequoia are alive. They have spirits that help us or hurt us. You would have us pray to a man who died a terrible death. And something you came across must have brought that to your mind, and I'm just wondering what that was.
Yeah, that was, you know, that's one of the last things I added to the book, Cynthia.
Really?
The very last, that passage you just read from. It was kind of a, I imagine, you know, voices in Sarah's head, and one is the Indian's voice that you just read. The other is a voice of nature. Trying to think exactly where that, because I have notes in my notebook from that. I might have written that actually when I was around here.
Really?
In Monterey or Carmel. It seems to me I was somewhere in Northern California near the coast and just marveling at the beauty of the Monterey Cypress and, you know, coastal redwoods in certain places around Santa Cruz. And thinking, you know, the Indian, these were alive. Nature had spirits.
Absolutely.
And how difficult it must have been for the early Indians to understand how a man nailed to a cross in a terribly violent manner could be an object of worship. There's one exception to that, and that would be the Luceño of the southern coast near where present-day Oceanside is, where Mission San Luis Rey is. The Luceño tribe, and to some extent the Juaninos, but mostly this is Luceño, believed in a deity called Wiat or Wiat, who, you know, is the product of a virgin birth, And he isn't nailed to a cross, but he is stung by a frog or some strange event, a poison that is secreted that brings him down. And instead of resurrecting, he does end up flying up after his death and becoming the moon.
Oh, interesting.
So there's this, you see?
A similar, yeah, almost a parallel.
Yeah, suffering, and even predicting that he would die this uh-huh. way, which Christ does too.
Sure.
And is worshipped for what he suffered.
Hmm.
Wyatt, the god Wyatt, who becomes the moon, the Luceño, perhaps more than any Californian tribe, accepted Christianity readily. And the largest population of Indians at a mission were in San Luis Rey.
That's very curious.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are these interesting connections between
yeah.
the two traditions that I try to elucidate or bring about or
Absolutely.
Discuss.
Absolutely. If you have a question for our guest today, Greg Orfila, you're welcome to give us a call at 899-5792. If we have time, we'd be happy to have you on the air, and you can ask the question directly. If not, you're welcome to send an email. simplelife@pilgrimsway.com is the email address for me. So feel free to take advantage of either of one of those modes of communication. Now, Greg, as the missions were established and soldiers and settlers came along too,
right?
The native people were displaced.
Yes.
And the plants and the animals that they had lived on and had done so for so many generations now were beginning to vanish.
Yes.
They were severely
yeah.
affected
many
by
were.
This
yeah.
this change. And so they moved to the missions in some cases just to survive.
Yes, it's sort of one of the great tragic ironies of the missions is that they were both protection and exposure. You know, when the germs came in with the Spanish settlers and with their cattle and with their sheep, of course, the fathers had no idea of how that happened. The biology of microbes was not revealed scientifically till later in the early to mid-19th century.
Mm.
So they didn't know what was happening. They didn't know the origin of what was happening, neither the priests nor the Indians. But the Indians in the villages knew people were dying. And in fact, a lot of children died young. Syphilis was also another problem.
Mm.
And the priests knew about that, and they knew it had something to do with, you know, sexuality, but exactly how and when, they weren't sure either. So what were the Indians to do? They saw a massive amount of people dying from illnesses that neither their shamans nor the priests could cure.
Right.
They were losing land and of course their bushes, their sources of seeds and whatnot were being trampled by the settlers' cattle. So they're losing food sources. They're dying out from illnesses nobody can quite pin down. They needed help.
Absolutely.
So the missions became a refuge. And the Father Serra's missions had food. They had clothing. And they had a place to put, you know, a place where you could have a roof over your head, so to speak. Protection from the outside. But they also, sadly, for the women in particular, put the women in close quarters, and in those cases the microbes spread even faster.
Oh,
so
sure,
it was just
did.
A terrible tragedy.
Now, you mentioned in your book, Greg, that the California Indian population at 150,000 in 1845,
right,
and then it dropped to 30,000
yes.
in 1870.
In 1860, I think, it went down a great deal. I can't remember the percentage, but from 150,000 to 30,000.
That's huge.
In about 12 to 15 years. That's the Americans. That's not the Spaniards. The Spaniards are gone.
By then?
Pretty much. By the gold rush. The gold rush, of course, completely sparks America's interest in California in 1848. And we win the war against Mexico as well. And with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, certain lands are divvied up. Texas stays with the United States. We know that story. California goes to the United States, and California in 1850 becomes a state. Well, you see what happens from, as you mentioned, the 150,000 Indians at the time, California becomes a state, and in 10, 12, 15 years, it's down to 30,000.
That's just mind-blowing.
So that wasn't the Franciscan fathers.
Right.
That was, I think 40% was due to illness. No, 60% due to illness and 40% due to murder.
Do you have any details on the murder part? I mean, was it... Yeah, you said the Spaniards were gone, so it wasn't the soldiers here. It was the settlers?
American soldiers.
American soldiers.
Yeah, and settlers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there was sometimes sizable skirmishes between the American Army and Indians in California. They're not as well documented as the great battles with Custer, you know, along the Great Plains, and the Little Bighorn and Wounded Knee. But there was, for example, the Modoc War against the Indians of the extreme northeastern part of our state in, I think, the 1870s. The Indians there were almost totally wiped out. There were other massacres, great massacres. There were very few, if any, attacks of that sort with the Spaniards. The Spaniards saw...
They had a different agenda, didn't they?
Well, they saw the Indian as having an inviolable soul. They saw the Indian as having a soul. And Father Serra, in fact, castigated one of the Spanish governors who made a reference to the Spanish rancheros as gente de razón, people of reason. And Serra said, are you implying that the Indians have no reason? Why are they not gente de razón? So you see where Serra was coming from, too.
Right. Absolutely. We are in studio today with author Greg Orfila, and he is just released his newest book, his ninth book, titled Journey to the Sun. It's a biography of Junipero Serra's life. For sale, beginning today, at Pilgrim's Way Community Bookstore in Secret Garden in downtown Carmel. When we come back, we're going to learn more about Father Serra, so stay tuned with us on Radio Monterey. I'm Cynthia Fernandez, and this is Simple Life. From that break. Thanks for staying with us. I'm your host, Cynthia Fernandez. We have Greg Orfila, author of his ninth book, Journey to the Sun, in the studio today. And we are having a wonderful conversation. I'm hoping we don't run out of time, actually. So, Greg, before we get too far in, I want you to share with us, if you will, the pivotal moment in Father Serra's life, because I know you know it.
Well, even the editors asked me when we first were discussing the book, and it took a while, you know, to find a good publisher. We were very lucky, after being turned down 12 times, to find the best one.
It always pays to not give up.
Yeah, isn't it? Scribner, you know, to be with Scribner, Hemingway and Fitzgerald's publisher, was just an honor for me. And my editor, Colin Harrison, was just tremendously dedicated to this story. He edited with me every one of the chapters, one by one, 22 chapters. There aren't too many editors
in
New York
that
will do that.
Yeah.
He was raised a Quaker, and I think he got this story somehow in his bones. But you asked me a question.
The pivotal moment
okay.
in Father Serra's life.
I think it has to do with this radical mercy that occurred in 1775, just after the Indians attacked Mission San Diego. I talk about two attacks on San Diego. First Battle of San Diego, Second Battle. It's like First Manassas, Second Manassas, you know, in the Civil War, our Civil War. The second Battle of San Diego when the Indians attacked, one of the priests, one of the Franciscan priests, who actually loved them very deeply and probably was one of the most kind, if not the kindest, in California, Father Luis Jaime, who had grown up very close to Sarah's home village in Majorca. He was a Majorcan. Was beaten to death, and his face was pummeled so badly he wasn't even able to be recognized by the Spanish authorities except for the tonsure on his head. Well, when this happened and the mission too was burned to the ground, it was a pretty severe attack on San Diego, like I say, in November of 1775. Sarah was not in San Diego. He was here in Carmel at San Carlos Borromeo, but he heard about it. The courier rushed up the coast, and when he found out, he was shocked. The Spanish comandante, whose name was Fernando Rivera, had rounded up about 15 Indians from the hills around San Diego, put them in shackles in prison, and presumably he was going to execute them.
So he presumed that they were responsible?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And Sarah was very disturbed by this. He knew this was a pivotal moment in the history of what he called the conquista espiritual, the spiritual conquest. So he wrote the viceroy a letter, a soul-searching letter, on December 15th, 1775, and sent it by courier to Mexico City. The viceroy's name was Bucareli. And this is what he said. I'm going to actually read you from the letter, because I think it's a very important document, not just for the founding of California, the California we know, but perhaps as a kind of alternate reading of the foundation story of our country that we don't get much of when we talk about the Puritans. This is the Spanish Catholic version of the start of our country. He reminded Bucareli of his insistence, quote, at the beginning of these conquests, that, quote, in case the Indians, whether pagans or Christians, would kill me, they should be pardoned. From the very outset of the Spanish movement into Alta California, Sarah seemed to sense violence was inevitable, and he wasn't going to return it. Nor did he want the military to return it. Sarah's insistent note to Bucareli was not only exceptional in its anticipatory mercy, it seemed to beg the question of the whole enterprise.
Hmm.
This is a stunning position. It's almost as if Sarah were asking for forgiveness not only for the Indian, but from him. Knowing what the Indian was going to have to give up, even if he felt he was offering a better way, salvation as he understood it. And then this is the final line, I'll quote this directly, that I think really is the pivotal point. Sarah tackled the clemency simply and profoundly. He asked for clemency for all the rebel Indians. Quote, to prevent the Indians from killing others, let the soldiers protect us in better fashion than they did the now deceased padre. And as to the killer, let him live so that he can be saved. For that is the purpose of our coming here and its sole justification.
Mm-hmm.
So, Cynthia, that's the gospel of love.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I'm really glad you shared that. Yeah, and I see that it touched you in a deep way.
It probably propelled me to write the book.
And so you knew about that before writing the book? You knew of that portion?
You know, I knew generally about the clemency move. I didn't know the specific... I don't think I read Father Sayer's actual letter till I was deep into the process, uh-huh. And it just pulled me even deeper.
No doubt. And that must be why the original manuscript was 1,300 pages.
Right. No, I blame that on my own insane self.
What was the criteria to edit 800 pages? I mean, what did you use to guide yourself?
Almost all of this last year, 2013, was just cutting one wave after another. Well, what would we use? Any digressions of more than, say, 3 or 4 paragraphs? Cut. any what my editor Colin Harrison calls what does he call it now? Front running. A term I've never heard of. Have you ever heard of that?
I haven't heard of that.
Well, front running in books is when you tell the reader what's coming.
Oh, I hate it when people do that.
Oh, in 100 years in San Diego, there would be a 4-lane highway.
Yeah.
He says, forget
don't do
it.
That.
People don't want to know about the 4-lane highway. They want to be lost in the 18th century.
They want the journey.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So a lot of front running was cut out, if not all of it. I don't know, just a lot of digressions, I think, that I fell in love with as an author, you know, looking in his narcissistic pool.
And then this is your 9th book, so you've been through this a while.
Yeah, I think it's probably more accurate to say it's my 7th, because I have 2 books I co-edited, which are not really, they're more like anthologies. But yes, 9 books entirely.
Is there another one on the way?
Tough question. I'm exhausted right now. I've never worked harder on a book in my life. As my wife knows, they're going to pull me, you know, they're going to put me in a hospital for a week. I've thought of a book about our son, Luke, who you just met today.
Yes.
Luke he has some disabilities, significant ones, but he's also a wonderful boy, brave boy. Luke once loves music, loves classical music, and he once listened to opera on NPR, I think, or on the radio. And he said, Daddy, you know what that is? We were just traveling in the car. I said, no, Luke, what is it? He says, that's Strong and Tender.
Oh.
And I think if I have enough anything left in my tank, my reserve tank, I'd do a small book about my son Luke and call it Strong and Tender.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, you know, we need personal, candid exchange. That's what this show is about.
Yeah.
And I think that when people have that, just spontaneous, candid exchange, everybody wins.
Yeah.
And for some reason, we so often feel like we're alone in whatever our circumstances are. And when we are able to relate to someone else, then it dawns on us, oh, it's not just me.
Correct.
And so I applaud you. I hope that you're willing and able to put some words to paper because there are a lot of folks who are probably in a very similar situation.
Yes, yes. We've met so many parents, you know, who have autistic children or Down syndrome children, children with all kinds of disabilities, cystic fibrosis. Over the years, we're very involved in Special Olympics, which is one of the great organizations I think ever created in the United States. Makes you proud to be an American.
Well, no doubt. You know, we are co-sponsored by Pilgrim's Way, the bookstore that you just visited today in Carmel. And I like to ask my guests a couple of consistent questions.
Sure.
One being what your favorite book of all time is.
Woo. Well, if it were one, I guess it would have to be the Bible. But I think if a close second would be Tolstoy's War and Peace.
And why do you choose those particular?
Well, the Bible, obviously the greatest book ever written, poetry in the Psalms, theological conundrums and extraordinarily deep, mysterious moral difficulties in the book of Job. You know, why do we suffer? Why do bad things happen to good people? The poetry, the mystical poetry of John's gospel, in the beginning was the Word was God. I'm not quoting it too well. Just the way he makes God into the Word. The beautiful work of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, that treats of women and the poor much more than the other three evangelists. The poetry and the meditations of the Psalms in the Old Testament.
And how about Tolstoy?
Tolstoy, woo, just everything, everything. I just love the characterization of Pierre and Andre and Natasha, the love of Pierre in that book. The ethic of, you know, we see the Napoleonic Wars, and we see war at its worst, you know, it's devastation, and the beauty of love rescuing the worst of war.
Those are two heavy-duty books. So what are you reading now?
Right now, I'm reading a great book on the Grand Canyon, actually, called The Emerald Mile.
Oh.
It's a very fine. My wife and I and Luke just went to the Grand Canyon for the first time, and my editor actually recommended it to me. He edited it for Scribner. It's hot off the press, too, and it's just a lovely book.
Is it a fiction or a...
It's nonfiction.
Okay, nonfiction.
Yeah.
And one last question, Greg. What do you envision for our future?
Our future? Our country or
you answer it how it strikes you.
Whoa.
I think it's... Let me just say this. I think that it's a piece of influence, perhaps power, that we all have to imagine.
Yeah.
Things into being, and I think that quantum physics is starting to sort of grasp some outer edge of that. And and I'm a firm believer in you know, being conscious as much as possible.
Yeah.
And so why not? You know, what do you envision for the future?
For the future. You know, I think human life is consistent from the beginning to the end. We suffer. We are proud. We don't often think of the group, what the consequences of our actions. We struggle with our ego every day. I think, you know, I'd like to see the future a more giving place. And I think maybe if we've learned anything, you know, it's to say, maybe I'm wrong, rather than to judge you first. Maybe I should say, you know, sorry.
Wow, I second that. Thank you, Greg, so much for being here. Author Greg Orfila, Journey to the Sun. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And our guest next week is going to be Chris Ann Brennan. She is also an author. She's a local. And she's published a book about her time and life with Steve Jobs. The book is titled The Bite in the Apple.
Ooh.
And so tune in for that. We'll be back with you next week. Her book, by the way, will be showing up in the bookstore at a book signing later this month, January 25th. She'll be in the bookstore from 1 to 3 on that Saturday afternoon. And we'll have another author that day later in the day by the name of Stuart Perrin, who wrote a book titled Little Sisters, about human trafficking. So I hope you enjoyed the show today. Again, come by and get your copy of Greg's book. And I look forward to spending time with you next Saturday afternoon on Simple Life. Take care. Simple Life. Oh.